Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I would suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my special guest is author Jack Martin. He was born and raised in California. After receiving his Juris Doctorate from UCLA, Jack worked for the Department of Defense and the aerospace industry, specializing in contracts and regulatory issues. While tracing his Californian ancestry back to the 1820s, Jack developed a passion for American history and the mystery genre. With encouragement and support from his beloved wife, Sonia, he began writing. Sonia passed away on Christmas Eve 2009 following a brave battle against ovarian cancer. He promised her he would finish the books and become a published author, and he has dedicated his first novel to Sonia, the love of his life. Before Brother Can You Spare a Dime, Jack had five Civil War mysteries published by Fireship Press, the Alfonso Clay Mysteries of the Civil War, which are as following: John Brown's Body, Battle Cry of Freedom, Marching Through Georgia, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and Hail Columbia. To learn more about the books, you can go to fireshippress.com, or you can visit Jack's website, which is simply jackmartin.com on the World Wide Web. So with that said, I'd like to welcome Jack. Jack, how are you tonight?
I am very well, thanks, Dave.
I'm very interested in getting into your books based on what we were talking about before the show, and that there's a supernatural element connected to your books, and perhaps I'm spoiling surprise here, but I'm especially interested in exploring the shadow side versus the light side of humanity that you were alluding to. So let's talk about your latest book, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? What can you tell us about the book?
Well, I was inspired to write it when I ran across a little-known fact of American history. Actually, two of them. The first one was that there was a serious attempt to assassinate Franklin Roosevelt 6 weeks before he became president in February of 1933.
Really?
The assassin missed him but killed the man sitting next to FDR, the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak.
Oh, yes.
To this day, historians speculate on what was really behind it. He was largely the assassin, a man named Zangara, was a trained sniper from the Italian army who had emigrated to this country. He missed FDR, but killed the mayor of Chicago. Was the mayor the real target? Some historians argue that. On the other hand, would the mob really want to take out a reforming mayor who was sitting right next to the President of the United States? You know, there's back and forth. In the real world, we cannot resolve what happened. All we do know Zangar was denied most access to the press, was tried, convicted, and executed within 6 weeks, which even in 1933 was moving awful fast. And a cynic would say that someone was very anxious to see him under the ground. And then, to tie it together, I was inspired, or perhaps just fascinated, by the much more famous case of the assassination of Governor Huey Long of Louisiana. Fictionalized versions of the assassination have been in some great movies. All the King's Men, for instance, both film versions. The official report said he was murdered by the son-in-law, a Dr. Weiss, the son-in-law of a judge, who Long had basically just passed a law to abolish his job, and that this was in revenge for the wrong done to his father-in-law. Dr. Weiss, the accounts differ. He was shot by Long's bodyguards at least 35 times. Some people argue as many as 60 times.
Wow.
Now, there is no question that Dr. Weiss fired two shots from a 380 ACP automatic pistol. Then his gun jammed. What is puzzling to this day, and many people attribute it, historians attribute it to sloppy autopsy and the like, is that Long was killed by a .32 caliber bullet. Now, many people say, well, the bodyguards had turned it into the OK Corral, and the hall of the Capitol building was marble and granite and a ricochet, except none of the guards had a .32. So conspiracy theorists argue that Weiss did shoot at Long. Both of his bullets are accounted for. One buried itself in a bench. The other hit the watch of a bodyguard, shattering it.
The hall of the Capitol building was marble and granite and a ricochet.
Can you excuse me just a minute? I'm getting a feedback. I know how to stop this.
Okay.
So conspiracy theorists argue that Weiss...
Yes. Any rate... Just for fun, I speculated, what if these two incidents were connected? And I take off from there. I have several goals when I write. One of them is to entertain. I'm not one of those people, you know, who, even though I have strong moral beliefs, I don't want to lecture people. I want them to draw their own conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Hidden in that, not hidden, but it's there if you want it, is the idea that some people who do great and good things, can also do horrible and inexcusable and unforgivable things.
Mm.
And that people who are absolutely monstrous, somehow, somewhere inside of them, they will do a kind action. Have a human feeling. a real-world example. And this by in no way, shape, or form excuses Adolf Hitler. But we hold Adolf Hitler as the gold standard of an evil man, right?
Yes.
He set out to murder, and to a certain extent succeeded, every Jew in Europe. No excuse in any way for that. Yet, when it came to the Jewish doctor who treated his mother for cancer for no fee, because as a teenager he couldn't afford it, he quietly got him a visa to Scandinavia and saved his life. There was something in the midst of that enormous evil that was the mind of Adolf Hitler, something that felt he owed the man something. It's also always fascinated me that people who can do evil things, evil by almost any standard, think they're doing good. I'm sure you've noticed the same thing, David.
Yes, I have. That's the ego saying that I'm right and you're wrong.
You see, I've read a lot about, for instance, the various terrorist groups under various names in the Middle East. And correspondents who get in there find that much of their leadership is kind to their families and don't kick their dogs. And yet they, as we saw in this horrific tragedy in the Sinai just this last week, they're perfectly content. They feel perfectly justified in blowing up a plane full of noncombatant civilians, many of them children and women. And they go home, have a nice dinner, and think they've done a good day's work. This is when people talk about horror, and in my novels there's an element of horror, I work it in. This is the most horrific thing. How you can find a good and a decent person who will do an awful thing. In the novel, well, before I go to the novel, I have to go to the controversy about a man most people, including myself, regard to be a great president, Harry Truman. He did order the incineration of two Japanese cities, which by that time in the war were largely civilian. There were no significant military or industrial targets in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And I don't turn away from, say, the British firebombing of Dresden. Now, many people say, well, the Nazis started it first. That is entirely true. So we make Adolf Hitler and the Nazis the standard for our morality. Now, Truman was a good man. And I'm not saying he was wrong to make that decision, because I'm sure you've heard or read about the War Department's estimates that would have cost 500,000 American lives and 5 to 6 million Japanese lives if we had had a conventional invasion of Japan to end the war. One can argue in this horrible calculus, it was far more humane to use the atomic bomb. But is this special pleading? I'm thinking aloud. You know, because we're on the side that used it, am I trying to make an excuse for us?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I am sincerely glad such a decision has never and will never be something I have to decide.
Well, let me ask you a question, just as a sure. digression. Do I understand that the Brother You Can Spare a Dime book has to do with the first assassination that you were referring to earlier?
You mean Franklin Roosevelt? Yes, that's the prologue starts with it.
Okay.
I think it grabs the reader's attention because I tried the experiment with people my son's age. Almost no one knows this happened. A couple of them tried to insist I had made it up for the book.
Mm.
It was open air in Miami. It also gives me an opportunity to give a very broad portrait of Franklin Roosevelt, a very great man, much to be admired, but not a perfect man. And I guess what I've aimed for, both in the Civil War books and in this most recent series, is to do in writing what film noir did for motion pictures. You're familiar with the term film noir?
Yes, I am.
They take place in a world where the authorities are ineffectual, almost hostile. And within this world, there are individual heroes who have their own ethical standards. Think Sam Spade. Think Philip Marlowe. We've all seen those great movies of the 40s. Sam Spade, let's take the example of the Maltese Falcon. He did things police couldn't and shouldn't do. And that allowed him to achieve, quote-unquote, justice where the police were unable to do it. In my novels, my protagonist, he reveres the United States. He's utterly devoted to it. He also has no trouble in breaking the laws of the United States. If in his opinion alone, he feels, quote-unquote, justice will be served. The very conclusion of Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Makes that very clear. I won't spoil it for people who might want to buy it and help a starving author, you know, get his royalty.
Right.
No. By all means, get a used one as cheaply as you can, anyone who's listening. I'm not a starving author. Matter of fact, I'm not starving either. Been working on my diet.
Good for you.
I want to get down to the point where obese is sufficient to describe me. You don't have to add another word. You know, like morbid or...
I hear you.
But coming back to my late wife, I know this sounds hackneyed, but it's absolutely true. The only woman I ever loved who loved me in return. She changed my life in so many ways. Without going into a pity party, I was heading into some bad places. She was a highly religious woman. And lived her life by religious standards. I regard myself as religious also, but I'm afraid I don't push a particular faith.
I just know that if Well, folks, we've lost Jack temporarily. I trust that he'll be calling back in. Interesting notion that he puts out, and that is that good people can do things that might be perceived as awful, and likewise that people who we might judge as evil can do good things. It takes into account this whole gray area of being human, and that is that we have light and shadow sides to ourselves, and many people aren't even aware of their shadow sides. And it's so important to embrace all of ourselves and not judge ourselves, so that we can ultimately make the choice to let go of those behaviors that don't serve us or others and walk in the light. And on that note, I'm going to go to our caller, Diana, to talk a little bit about this until, oh, Jack is back. Hold on, Diana, I'll get to you. Jack, I'm coming to you. Hold on. So, Jack, anyhow, lost you for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know
there.
What happened. I'm calling from a hard line, not a cell phone, and it just blinked out.
Every once in a while, people get dropped for whatever reason. It's never happened with a guest before, so have no fear. It's highly unlikely that will happen again. But can you pick up the thread with where you left off? I was just having a discussion about light and shadow and how it's all part of the human experience, and that a lot of times people aren't even aware of their shadow sides, their darker sides, and how important it is to come to terms with it in order to make the choice to walk in the light and let go of behaviors that are not serving ourselves or others. Would you have any comment to make on that before we return
I know exactly what you mean by that. And I felt it myself. I mentioned my wife turned me from certain paths I was on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not talking politics in any way, you know, not liberal, conservative, not Republican or Democrat, but Dr. Ben Carson has been getting a lot of flack recently, I see, because he tells of his violent tendencies as a teenager. And in an interesting turn, a lot of the press saying, well, you're lying when you say you were nasty. You were actually a pretty nice kid, you know, which is an odd way to attack a candidate. But at any rate, yes, I had my personal demons. They hurt myself and they hurt others. I fought them very much. But it was Sonia that really led me into what you could call the light. Taught me that I wasn't an awful person. That we had inside of all of us, I'm paraphrasing, she didn't use these exact words, the capacity for good and the capacity for evil. And the fact you have that capacity does not make you evil. Giving into that capacity makes you evil. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. It's that whole duality thing that is part of our human experience, and it makes absolute sense to me. And there's no judgment attached to it. In the way that you put it, which I appreciate.
It's like I've long been a fan of classic horror literature, and one of the greatest is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which, by the way, the author, Robert Stevenson, said he just had a nightmare and just wrote it down. Mm. My God, I don't want his nightmares.
Mm-mm.
But what a lot of people overlook in reading the novel or seeing one of the many film versions is the real monster isn't Mr. Hyde. It's Dr. Jekyll. He's created Mr. Hyde so he can do evil things without consequences. And then he retreats through this magical formula back into the perfectly respectable Dr. Jekyll. But if you want to go into a metaphor, at some point, suddenly he ceases to have the ability. The medicine no longer works. He has indeed become Hyde because he gave in to these impulses. Now, people can be influenced in so many different ways. I was influenced by a good woman. I was also influenced by parents who had very high standards. Sometimes it was hard to live up to them. But I'm glad I tried. And in a weird way, you know, coming back to the novels, I play with those notions. The protagonist in the... I won't do a big reveal on it for those who are interested in reading them, but the protagonist in the Civil War novels literally has a demonic element in his bloodline. Literally. And he is aware of it. But his father trained him to put that under control. That it was, in 19th century terms, it was dishonorable to give in to that. By the way, David, have you noticed that the word dishonorable has almost gone out of our lexicon?
Yes, I have. Interesting point.
For instance, I think about this a lot because I teach night classes in law and ethics. And I try to bring this to the students' attention. People now say, well, there was nothing illegal in what I did. And that may very well be true. But was it dishonorable? I can think, I could name, I'm sure you could name many, many actions that are horrible, disgraceful, but are legal.
Sure.
Now, yes, there was a lot of hypocrisy in prior times. You know, people who would say they were honorable would do very, very dishonorable things. But I do remember what the author Oscar Wilde once said about hypocrisy. He said, it's the tribute that vice pays to virtue.
Oh, I love Oscar Wilde.
Yeah. He was a complicated man, and he helped bring about his own destruction, but he wasn't an evil man. And he understood a lot of things, and he could say them in a very hilarious way.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, he would have understood perfectly why so many inner city kids these days have trouble, you know, with ethics, with morals, because it requires two parents. In one of his plays, he once said that every woman grows up to be her mother, that's her tragedy. No man does, That's his.
Mm.
In a roundabout way, pointing out it wasn't enough to be influenced by your father. You needed the mother. I'm sorry if I've gone on too much of a tangent. Would you like to draw me back to something more of your direct interest?
Well, I'm interested in this idea of lack of ethics and how that plays into your character, which, as I understand it, that he spans the time period from the Civil War series into this later time period, decades later. And I'm interested in hearing about that as well. And then we can talk about some of the other things that you raised.
The one of the supernatural elements in the series is this part demonic ancestry he has rendered him to a certain extent immortal. I say to a certain extent, yes, he could be killed, but he's hard to kill, he doesn't age, and he heals very quickly. But of course, people notice it if you don't age. So the backstory is he knows he has to disappear for a while. He views his goal in life as to serve the United States, to put his abilities at the disposal of the United States. So he does disappear, gets a new name. He claims to have been born in Galveston, Texas, which is clever of him, because if you're up on your Texas history, you know that in the year 1900, a freak hurricane destroyed the city and killed 8,000 people and destroyed all local documents.
Right.
This creates a blank sheet for him. Yeah, he can't show where he was born or any close relatives. Tragically, they all drowned, you know, that kind of thing, and no one could prove otherwise. But there are people. He works now for the Bureau of Investigation. For those purists, the FBI didn't become the Federal Bureau of Investigation until 1939. It was known as simply Bureau of Investigation before then. And J. Edgar Hoover, he's not well thought of today, but he was an intelligent man. He's suspicious. He knows there's something wrong. But he also knows that this is one of his very best agents. I talk a little bit about Hoover, too, you know, the good versus bad. He was head of the FBI from 1927 to 1972. Think about that. 1927 to 1972.
It's a long time.
He got the job as a young man because no one else wanted it. It was full of corrupt officials taking bribes from bootleggers, useless cousins and sons and nephews of senators and congressmen. Well, he wanted to create a clean agency. So he started to do it, and he was successful by using blackmail. He started a system of getting the goods on politicians who were usually the patrons of these various agents. For instance, this is history. Franklin Roosevelt had a mistress. FDR wanted to get rid of Hoover, who was acting quite independently. He didn't like political interference with his agency. It was his agency. And in his mind, he was doing good. It wasn't blackmail. I actually put this line in the novel. It wasn't blackmail, it was patriotism. And, you know, sometimes people can justify these things.
Sure.
Well, FDR is about to demand his resignation when Hoover just silently throws the pictures and the transcripts of a session he'd had with a sprightly young thing. Which, incidentally, is true. He doesn't even say anything. You know, it just says, there will be no political interference with my agency. And a shaken FDR says, what about these? He says, oh, you can keep them. They're just copies.
Double.
And we do know one of the reasons he was head of the FBI for so long is that he always found the goods. Now, he always thought he was doing good. Was he, in fact? Well, I'll give you an example. Do you know how many successful acts of Axis terrorism happened in the United States in the Second World War?
No idea.
None. Not one. It wasn't that they weren't trying. For instance, in 1943, a submarine landed 8 trained saboteurs in New Jersey. FBI was waiting for them on the beach. I'm not sure of the details about how they knew where the submarine was going to surface and put them off in rubber boats. He was quite successful. But once again, at what cost? We're also, and I deliberately wanted to set it during the time of the Great Depression, the latest novel, because that was a time when the country was pretty close to going in awful directions, either communist or fascist. Capitalism seemed to have failed everyone. Do you know, at the depth of the Depression in 1933, calculated in the way that we calculate it today, between 35 and 40% of the adult labor force was unemployed?
Wow.
I mean,
knew it was. Yeah.
I have a picture in one of my the books I collected of the time. It showed a riot in Chicago involving several thousand people outside an upscale restaurant that had advertised there were 2 jobs for waiters. The birth rate was cut in half, down to about 1.3 per couple. There were lots of potential dictators and demagogues. And you know, if I'd lived in those times, I'm not sure I wouldn't have been listening out of the sheer desperation. Perhaps the greatest service Franklin Roosevelt gave us is he gave us hope we could get out of this without sacrificing our freedoms, the things that made America great. But it wasn't that everyone just, fell down and worshipped at his feet. A few did. There were people like Huey Long, Father Coughlin, Townsend, nearly was elected governor here in California. People with very strange ideas. And anti-Semitism was in the air. You know, that's something I've never been able to understand, but whenever things go bad economically, it seems there's some people who say it's got to be the Jews' fault. I've never understood that. Why?
No, I haven't either. But let me see if we can get back to the book a little bit, because we're in the final 20 minutes and we do have a caller on the line. I'm curious as to how J. Edgar Hoover plays into your storyline.
He provides cover for Harry Bierce, the name my protagonist goes by in this incarnation.
Mm.
By cover, I mean this. Hoover dislikes Bierce. He dislikes him as a person, and he dislikes him because he suspects there's something very, very wrong with him. But Bierce delivers the goods. And as much as Hoover chastises, shouts at, threatens Bierce, there's a scene where FDR himself wants him fired. And his response is, "I will be goddamned if any politician will take down my best agent."
Mm.
And then he's thinking, and he says, "Did I actually say that?" Because yeah, he does not like him.
Yeah.
At the end, he suspects Bierce because Bierce has no background. Yes, he says about Galveston, but he still doesn't buy it. And at the end, I have a little reveal where buried in the right-hand door of his enormous desk, Hoover has a picture of General William Tecumseh Sherman's victory parade past the president and General Grant in the summer of 1865. And in it is there is a officer who looks exactly like Bierce, except for longer hair.
Hmm.
And he's thinking, could be an uncle, a grandfather, but my gut says no. And I listen to my gut.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. I like to give...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
And then I have a question
for
you. I
like to give a little bit of humor from time to time. If you're unrelentingly bleak, it's not fun to read.
That's
so
true.
I try from time to time to show the humorous side of, for instance, at one point, Bierce is leaving Hoover's office, and Hoover is fighting himself not to throw his desk lamp at the door.
Hmm.
And the idea of this man who, with everyone else, he had perfect control over the FBI, in real life as well as the novel. He doesn't have perfect control of this man. And I find that humorous. I think the readers will too.
Let me ask you a question. How did you decide to introduce this demonic element, if you will, that spawned Bierce? I'm very curious what your impulse was behind doing that.
Well, there were two reasons. Number one, growing up, I was a great fan of the horror writer Howard Phillips Lovecraft. I don't know if you're familiar with his works.
No, I've heard the name, though.
He is the most famous writer you've never read. However, people as diverse as Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Peter Straub. They all say he deeply influenced them. A lot of people don't like his style today. He wrote in a manner that was old-fashioned even in the 1920s and 30s when he was at his most successful. Lovecraft had an obsession with, in the pre-DNA days, they'd call it taint of the blood. It's very easy to know what was going on, though he would not talk about it. His father died of tertiary syphilis, and his mother probably died of it as well. Now, he was a self-taught but very educated man. He knew what his parents died of, and I imagine he couldn't help but think, is this in me? So in his stories, someone once said, I wish I'd thought of it, every novel is an autobiography of the author.
It's true.
He is obsessed with people having, shall we say, unnatural ancestry. One of his greatest stories, The Rats in the Wall, an old English aristocrat discovers that he's descended from a line of Celtic cannibals that predates the Romans.
Oh, my.
And he ends up himself attempting to eat one of the people. And on it went. Now, perhaps why that spoke to me is I had a grandfather and an uncle. Let's just say they were not good men. And yes, you know, you're responsible for your own fate, your own soul. But in the dark of night, you wonder, is that in me? Could I go that way? And writing about this, I guess it helps to exorcise, if you know what I mean, those thoughts I've had for half a century. I now know I am not what they were. But it's symbolic. And every intelligent person knows you are not condemned by your genetic relationship to an evil person. Did you know that Adolf Hitler's three closest blood relatives all live out here in California?
I had no idea.
They're grandnephews. Now, don't look up in the directory for Hitler. They have changed
their
names.
Well, let me get you back on track for a minute, Jack, because we're running low on time. What was the second reason that decided to bring in this demonic influence into the book? You've alluded to the
first
one.
Partly as a tribute to Lovecraft, and partly as a way of symbolically bringing the fears that I had since childhood out of me.
Interesting.
And I spent a great deal of my life repressing feelings. Only relatively late in middle age did I discover that is wrong. You repress your fears, your feelings, and they just, it's like a couch with a lumpy spot, you know what I mean? You press down the lumpy spot, Another one pops up over there.
Yes, indeed. I can relate.
And let's make this 2.5 reasons. When my wife was so ill, she went through hours and hours of chemotherapy, and hours and hours of dialysis. And I was able, by telling her stories, I'd make up on the spur of the moment, to make the time pass, to entertain her, and to make the fear go away.
Beautiful.
And so if I can entertain people, that's half a point as far as I'm concerned.
I'd
like entertaining
that,
people.
That's a really big point when it comes to writing and reason for reading books. I'd like to just take we do have a caller on the line, and we don't have a lot of time left. I'd like to see what she might have to say to you.
Sure.
I'm going to go to Diana. Hi, Diana. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you, David?
I'm doing well, thank you. Wanted to reflect on anything that's been said tonight, or if you had any questions or comments to Jack.
Well, I know that Roosevelt, he was into healing waters and had even invested in some holistic healing spring waters. And I was wondering if that had anything to do, like in these day and ages, even since 2007 up to now, you hear of alternative healing doctors getting murdered by the CIA or whoever. People who tried to kill Roosevelt, did it have anything to do with his holistic healing ventures or not?
I'm back on the line. My deepest
I know,
apologies.
I noticed you left. Did you hear her question to you?
Oh, he left.
Could you repeat
okay.
it, Diana?
Well, I'm different. I'm going away from the evil part. With Roosevelt, he was into holistic healing waters, into spring waters, and he even bought some land and was having other people come. And I just wonder if that was part of what they didn't like about him, what may have gotten him almost assassinated or had an attempt.
That is a very perceptive question. One of the things I touch on in the novel is the completeness of his crippling. He had no use whatsoever for his legs. Now, he wasn't left incontinent, and apparently he could, quote-unquote, perform. But today, it probably wouldn't matter. For instance, in Texas, a paraplegic has been elected governor. But then, crippling was seen as a sign of weakness. Now, everyone knew he'd suffered from polio. But polio, which is now a disease in history books, one of my earliest memories was 4 when the last epidemic went through L.A. But polio could kill you outright. It could leave you slightly paralyzed in one limb. It could leave you completely paralyzed from the neck down. And you didn't know until some weeks after you were infected. There was terror in polio that you didn't get in many diseases. He was always into the waters because doctors of the time said, and they had no basis for saying it, that it would help possibly give him partial use of his legs. It didn't. There was no way it could have. On the other hand, it gave him an opportunity to relax. I'm sorry?
I think it was helpful to him and a lot of other people, and that's why people were buying into this and doing other holistic adventures, because of what they were all getting together and healing each other in a supernatural way.
He was very active, on top of everything else, in the March of Dimes, which originally was just devoted to polio. he went to great lengths to conceal. For instance, he loved, like in my novel, which it happened in the real assassination attempt, he loved giving speeches from the backs of open cars. You see, he had complicated leg braces, which he could manipulate and appear to stand. With the aid of canes, he was seen to walk. In point of fact, he was just swiveling his hips, giving the impression of walking. And he did this sort of thing because if he was viewed as, quote-unquote, a true cripple, people would turn away from him in disgust and pity. They wanted, in those days, they wanted their leaders to be physically whole specimens, which was wrong of them. In point of fact, the way he faced his disability was an astonishing effort of will. He was a rich man. He could have retired to his country house and been waited on hand and foot and bemoaned himself. No, he got back on the horse. And by the way, every single day, every day, he was in pain. I hope that answers your question.
Well, what was their reason for wanting to kill him?
Well, that's where we get into speculation. All we know about Giuseppe Zangara
We've only got minutes left, so we need to make it brief.
I think Zangara just wanted fame. He was a pathetic man, not quite 5 foot tall, and extremely homely. Just like several of the people who've successfully assassinated our presidents, he wanted fame. Didn't care how he got it.
Interesting. Well, Diana, any final comments before we sign off for the night?
Well, it's all very interesting. I'm not a historian, but it makes for a good bedtime story.
But it will give you a little of the feeling of the time if you get the book.
Yes.
It sounds fascinating, and I imagine a lot of research went into it, Jack. I wish we had time to talk about that. But I thank you very much for coming on the show tonight, and you are truly a walking encyclopedia.
I thank you for giving me this opportunity, David.
You're very welcome.
Good night to you, and good night to the listeners.
Okay, bye-bye. Good night, everybody. And Diana, thank you for your comments and your continuing support of my program. So, once again, we come to a close. Now we pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we allow it to be. Have a great week. Remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.
If you'd like to be part of a group hypnosis session that can deal with any situation that you may have in your life, tune in on Friday, November 13th, for Joanne Eady. And my show is now broadcast on Monday, Thursday, and Friday. Good night, and God bless.